It's the Tanana-Yukon Historical Society May meeting, last Thursday of April. The speaker for the evening will be John Miskovich.
After he talks a minute or two.
Oh. We have with us tonight Mr. John Miskovich, who is conducting a mining operation in the Iditarod, or in Flat.
Otter Creek.
Otter Creek. And is one of the oldest operators in that whole country. And will you tell us where you were born, John, and the other year?
Well, I was born claim of discovery on Otter Creek, which is about 3 miles from the town of Flat, and about 11 miles from the town of Iditarod, on March the 7th, 1918, a very windy day. And I've lived there my whole life.
And your father and mother were?
My father was one of the early prospectors that went in there in 1910, and my mother was sent over from Yugoslavia in 1912, and they were married there in Iditarod, and raised 7 of us children there, 4 boys and 3 girls.
And would you give their names so we can get them on the record?
My father was Peter Miskovich, and my mother was Stana Miskovich. Her maiden name was Stana Bugoy, who was also a pioneer of Iditarod. And then there's George Miskovich, my older brother, and Eva, my older sister, and then I'm John, number 3, and then there's Ann Miskovich, Olga Miskovich, Howard Miskovich, and Andrew Miskovich, the youngest.
And you aren't married, are you?
Yes, I'm married, and I have 3 children now, Peter Miskovich the 2nd, and Maria Miskovich. Peter is 5, Maria is 3, and Sandra is 2. And my wife also comes from Yugoslavia, where my mother came from.
I'd like to see if this is recorded.
Fine.
Go ahead.
Will you tell us about how your father got started mining there and what happened in the early days? Can you give us a picture of the country there?
As you all know, Mr. Reed, one of the things that brought all the old stampeders or the pioneers to Alaska was the news of the gold strikes that took place in the 1900s and on through 1910 and 1916. However, my dad was in Wilkeson, Washington, and he was working in a coal mine underground in 1910, and he read of the Iditarod strike and how rich it was, and so he didn't like coal mining and he didn't like to work underground, so he just took off from Wilkeson, Washington, and headed for Iditarod. And so he got there in the fall of 1910, and of course, as all prospectors, they do most everything when they get there to get along. So he was cutting wood first before he got a few claim stakes, and he was also working on the famous tramway as a section foreman from Flat to Iditarod that operated a Model T Ford. Well, first it was horses and mules pulling trams or cars on the tramway, and then they went to Model T Fords, and the Mutchler brothers operated them for several years there, hauling freight the distance of 8 miles from Iditarod to Flat, and then the road went in and the tramway went out. And in 1916, my dad was able to get enough ground together there on Discovery, where he set up a small hoist and steam boiler and gin pole, and with a brother that came over later on, he started mining in the winter of 1916, doing underground mining there on Discovery, which was all that was going on at that time. And from 1916 on, of course, considerable progress took place. There were many ups and downs, and mostly downs until about 1935 when the tractor came in. But during that period of history, of course, he accomplished a great deal and did a great deal to advance the methods of mining and proved to everybody that he wasn't going to go broke in fulfilling the dreams that he had when he left Wilkeson, Washington. So There is a long history to Iditarod and Flat and Otter and Flat Creek, and of course it would require a very long recording to go into all of it. However, we have been a very major part of the development of that district down there, which I still operate in, and I'm really sorry to see it dwindling away, and all the historical monuments, you might say, that are down there gradually disappearing. So it was one of the reasons I came up this evening, because I am extremely interested in trying to tell the story of Iditarod and Flat and Otter, and make more people interested in the things that I'm extremely interested in preserving. And as an example, my father and mother ran a bathhouse at Flat for many years when we were small children, and of course he made his own steam boiler, which is there yet today, and he took the same engine that he had on the hoist, which he was drift mining with, and he converted that for power on the washing machine. And my mother washed with that machine, and it will still run today, as Jim knows, and is a very antique piece of equipment, which in those days was very modern. And there are many, many other things in Iditarod and Flat and on Otter, which I feel are of extreme interest to people, if they can appreciate the era that they were used in and what people did in order to survive with that equipment and make its use provide for their daily bread and butter, so to speak.
Didn't they have an awful time getting their freight in there up in the Iditarod River?
Yes, that was a real tough problem. They went from, of course, Fairbanks down the Yukon and then up the Anoka and then up the Iditarod, and of course during the dry seasons they used, for a long period of time, they used horses and mules ahead of the barges. They'd have them get off during the shallow water places, and then they would pull the barges, and it had been one of the toughest problems, I think, in developing the area, actually. And then, of course, when the river froze up, they had the winter freighting going on there for years, from Ophern to Cotton and from Ruby. And as an example, when one of the dredges broke a crankshaft, which weighed, I imagine, about 3 ton there, they hauled it in by dog team. Now, anybody today would hear such a story, they would say, you're not telling the truth, but that is a fact. And some of the things that were done physically, actually today, are somewhat impossible. I would say, really, they're fairy tales, actually, is what they are. I forgot how many they had, but they had a terrific number of dogs with manpower. Yes. I went through the... I wasn't born yet when George Riley was shot there, which was a very sad part in the history of Flat, the Riley Investment Company dredge, which he started, and he was another very progressive pioneer. And then, of course, I also went through the era of the mail robbery, the Riddle of the Roadhouse, which was one of the most outstanding cases Fairbanks had, I guess, and where she was acquitted and went free, the Black Bear, as she was known at that time. And then, of course, I saw the first airplane come into Flat, which was Bennett, who started out from Fairbanks here and flew into Flat. And I helped build the, as a small boy, the first airport there. And then I also saw Wiley Post's famous landing there, and of course his takeoff, which I was a very small part of, but an important one, and when he broke his round-the-world flight, as you know, with the Winnie Mae. And there are many firsts in that area which we took part in, and it would take me quite a little time to review them all.
Didn't your family have a whole creek there afterwards and mine on it by hydraulic methods?
Yes, we. It's a funny thing what happened in those years that my father was working there. He saw what they were doing, and he saw where their bedrock was not being cleaned. And as you know, bedrock is where you want to look for the best pay. And so as the claims were let go, he restaked them. And of course, in this restaking process today, we own the entire Otter Creek area, you might say, for 3 miles long. And this is rather coincidental that we should have remained there, and after everybody had felt it was all worked out, my dad felt it wasn't, and of course we did do real well before the war there in ground that everybody had assumed was not going to be profitable, and it was all due to the fact that my father had the foresight to look into mining machinery, which was more modern, and he shipped the first tractor in into Flat, the first diesel, and first backhoe, and developed the hydraulic elevator in that area, and steel boxes, and a very efficient type riffle, put the first hydroelectric plant on Otter Creek, which we operated for many years, developing power for our pumps and our electricity in our camp, and he was a firm believer in roads, and he was very instrumental in getting the road up the valley, which is now on gravel rather than one on the hillside, which was in mud. And he was a first in many, many things in Alaska in that area. And as I said, he was a very forceful type of individual with a very limited education.
It doesn't take an education to be a smart man.
Well, an education is a wonderful thing, of course, but like everything else, you have to know how to apply it and where to apply it. And in Flat, it took more backbone than it took anything else, and muscle.
How did your kids go to school there?
Well, at Flat, there was a grade school, which we all went through, and our family was practically the school at Flat, and we all went through school as individuals, you might say, with probably one student with us. The rest of the time, we were all in school as individuals, and that was a class. There was a time then where there was 11 children, there were 7 of us Miskoviches, so we had the schoolhouse pretty much to ourselves. And it was quite interesting in those school days there, putting on Christmas programs and doing things that today they don't do as much of or take as great an interest in, but we were really Shakespearean artists during those early days.
When was the Riley started the first dredging there, was it?
Yes, George Riley brought the first dredge into Iditarod, which is a wooden hull, and it started in 1914 on Discovery, just a short ways from where I was born, and that dredge was rebuilt in 1938, and that's the dredge that I'm operating today. And it's really a historical monument, and it's got the same engine in it that's been in it for 40 years or 41 years, but someday that whole dredge, I believe, will be a monument to dredging in Alaska when we get through probably in 5 or 6 years. But George Riley was a man who had a great deal of faith in Alaska, and he was a great promoter, and of course he not only operated in Flat or on Otter Creek, but he was in the Tolstoy and he was in the Manly Hot Springs area, and he was a man that Alaska needed very badly at that particular time.
Do you know Tom Jensen?
Yes, I knew Tom real well, and Tom came to Flat some years later after the stampede, of course. He came there actually after the war, but I believe he was there during the earlier days, and Mr. Donnelly, of course, was another outstanding pioneer of our district who started the bank and developed the navigation on the river, and he was a real asset to the area there for many, many years.
I used to play basketball with
yes,
him.
Yes, he was in Nome prior to coming to Flat as a boy. But Flat has many things that could fit into this historical society program, so to speak, and I would like to see an old tractor that we have at Flat, which is down on the bank of the Iditarod, brought up this summer, and I'd like to get Art Peterson to bring it in, because he's going to be in Flat hauling a load in from Galena for the Agos, and it's a tractor that they use to haul wood for a power plant that the Guggenheims had there when they ran a big dredge on Flat Creek itself. And this tractor was steam-powered, and it could haul 100 cords of wood on sleds on a road which was snowshoed down and then sprinkled with water, so it would make a real icy bottom. And this tractor could really be a monument to some of the early pioneering of transportation. And I would like to see it brought up. Now, I have some other things down there, which, as an example, this steam engine and washing machine and steam boiler, it could be brought out and put back into operation again, and probably take in a little laundry if necessary. And there are some other items, such as our hydraulic elevator, and I have numerous pictures that I've taken and I've kept. I have a lot of them in California of those early days, which is almost a fairy tale today when you look at them. And I think if we can get Art to do it, I'd like to see that tractor brought to Fairbanks. It's quite a little job, but I think it'd be well worth doing. I think it would be an interesting piece of equipment to see what they did to get away from horses. And that's been the main reason, I think, for a lot of our advanced machinery, was to get away from the hay burner, as they called it, so to speak.
The big horseman down there, I used to know him. He used to have a big trucking...
The Mutchler brothers. Jake Mutchler and George Mutchler. And they were there for many years and took part in all the heavy machinery that was hauled in, as you know, during those early days. And it's, again, as I said, almost a fairy tale to see what has been hauled in boilers and dredges and all the other parts there where we didn't have the big tractors we have today. And not only tractors, but other equipment that you use in moving heavy machinery on the barges.
Do you know Kilroy?
No, I didn't know Kilroy, but I've heard of him. Yes, I didn't know him.
Rasmussen?
No, I didn't. There was a Rasmussen there years ago, but that was before my time. Many of those names ring a bell through the discussions my dad had with me, but I still like to tell everybody I was a small boy.
I'm beginning to date myself. I talk anymore. Can you tell us any more about the life there, how the people live?
Well, probably the most interesting thing of life itself there was the fact that my mother, who I give an awful lot of credit to, I've talked a lot about my father, and my mother's still living in Seattle at 84 years of age, but we were all born at Flat without the aid of hospital or doctors. And there was 10 of us children, there's 7 of us living, two died before the oldest boy and one after the youngest, but it's almost unbelievable today that we all survived and came out quite healthy and without the aid of all your modern science and your modern medicine and everything that you have today. And I believe that is one of the things and one of the outstanding accomplishments of that whole area, not only my mother but many of the mothers of the area, the suffering and the hardships they went through in order to be pioneers and raise a family. And there's a story that my mother always tells, which is always amusing. Her honeymoon was to ride from Iditarod to Discovery and cook breakfast for 6 men the next morning. So when I tell that to young people of the day, it's quite hard for them to believe. And then my dad didn't have very much money, so he bought her a very cheap diamond ring, and of course washing clothes was a very important part of the duties them days, and the set fell out of the ring, the diamond fell out of the set, and she lost it. And so for several days she wouldn't tell my father that she had lost the diamond, which she thought he surely was going to be mad over. And so when she finally got courage to tell him that she lost the diamond, he took a look at it and he says, "Well, what are you worrying about? You still have the ring." that was some of the romance during those days. But the women of those early days really and truly deserve an awful lot of credit, and the hardships, as I said, that they endured was quite terrific. Of course, the early mail carrying days was of great interest to everybody, how they used to carry the mail and meet a schedule there every week, just as close as, or even closer, I believe, than the airplanes today. And, of course, we enjoyed the winters in those days because we lived in Flat, and I lived there until 1930 when I came to Fairbanks to go to high school, but everybody had a very active community program, and it was a spirit which you don't find today anywhere. And it's an unfortunate thing, but we really had a spirit there that made everyone enjoy every week their dancing and their Christmas programs and all the big celebrations. And the Pioneers, of course, were one of the very active lodges that were there.
Did they ever have the Arctic Brotherhood there, too?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. That was in Iditarod.
Mm-hmm.
See, Iditarod had about 7,000 people at one time, I believe, from what I've been told, and 18 or 20 saloons, and they had a moving picture. It was an incorporated city, and they had a telephone company, they had a printing press, they had practically everything that you have in Fairbanks today. That's hard to believe. And then Flat, of course, was another city, and Discovery also had a city with a number of saloons and a moving picture theater, and it also was a going concern on the hill opposite Otter Creek. So as you drive up there today, and you go down to Iditarod, and you look around, if you stop and think a moment and just close your eyes, you can just visualize the thousands of people walking the wooden sidewalks, and some are still there, and how they all got along, and how everybody managed is something that I can't understand to this day. 10 or 11,000 people could have been in that area fighting the battles of the gold rush. Yes, sir. And it's really something. There's a lady there at the Sitkanal. Tootsie is her name. She's a colored lady, and she was one of the pioneers of Otter Creek, or Iditarod, rather, and later moved to Flat. But she was probably one of the most outstanding individuals I think Alaska's ever had. And it's a funny thing, she's in Sitkanal, and E.B. Collins is there now, and at one time she was in Fairbanks on a trial for bootlegging, and he was the district attorney at the time, and of course he put her in jail for 6 months and fined her $500, and when he was running for office and he came down the Flat, I took him over to Tootsie's. She was running a little roadhouse there, and when she saw him, she says, "Mr. Collins, I don't know whether I want to kiss you or kill you." And they're down there together in Sitka, where she's blind now and quite old. But there's many, many tales of individuals, which it's unfortunate they haven't recorded a lot of them. And it would be amusing and interesting reading today.
There was never any game in that country, was there?
There wasn't in the early days, but the game is coming back now. There's more game there now than I've seen in many, many years in my lifetime. And I think it's due a great deal to the wild shooting that's going on along your civilized highways of Anchorage and Fairbanks, and the game know once they get around where we are, they're protected. And we have ducks and geese and beaver and moose now and caribou coming in there. We have a lot more game than I've ever seen. And of course, we don't bother them there, so probably a good reason for them to be there.
I heard when I was a boy that there wasn't any game.
No, there wasn't. That's a funny thing. That was a very poor area for game, isn't it? It's something to do with the hills, probably, or the mountains. I don't know. But that is a fact.
I don't... can you... Well, you came up to Fairbanks to go to high school, and then you went back and went to work, and can you tell us about the development, the Intelligiant that you fellows did?
Well, that would be another long, long story. And of course, the Intelligiant development started after we moved from Flat to expand our operation over to another area at Ruby and Poorman and Flat Creek. And there, of course, we had a new creek with a lot of overburden, and it was necessary there, of course, to change the method of stripping overburden with the manual giant, so to speak, and get back to something that, again, would cut costs and increase production and work 24 hours a day. So I have a film on it now, which I made this winter, and if possible, I might be able to show it Monday night at the Pioneers meeting, which might be of interest. I don't know who's on the committee, but it would tell the story better than if I were to try to tell you here that it started at Poorman and continued for a number of years going up and down, mostly down, for 20 years now, in fact, I believe. Jim here was an early... a partner of mine way back when we were considering it a business here in Fairbanks. And I will say that it's probably a story that someday will be the most interesting one that Alaska's ever had, because it did start in Alaska, and Alaska can take credit for it. And it's going to be a part of a stripping program in Kotzebue this summer, moving an airfield approach. And from that, I believe we'll be able to tell the story a lot better after we get that job going, so that it can be understood, and it'll make possible what the Intelligiant automatic controlled water power really means. And it's a machine which I've spent a good many, many years on, and many, many thousands of dollars in developing, and it's just now reaching the stage where it is starting to be respected and it's being accepted. But it has taken 20 years to get that done, and 20 years of design and failures and promotion and getting people to believe in what you think and what you know it can do. And it took a lot of patience and perseverance. That's about all I can say that was required to keep it alive. Otherwise, it would have died on the vine like a lot of other things, and there it would have stayed. It would have been another quack idea that some fella had that didn't follow it through. But it is now in firefighting, in the missile program, and in the pulp industry. It's beginning to start in all directions that originally it was intended for, but in order to get it there, it has had to have a lot of coddling, and I've been the father of that coddling.
What year did they start on that?
Well, it actually started in 1941 in a thinking way, and then right after the war in 1945, 1946, why the actual physical work started on it. And 48 was the first actually model, you might say, that we used up here in Foreman, and then continued to use them there until we shut down there. Unfortunately, the values of the ground on the property we intended them for didn't hold up, so we couldn't make a name for ourselves up here with it, and then the FE started to shut down. Gold mining, generally speaking, went downhill, and of course, the miners, generally speaking, didn't accept it. It was a funny thing. There was a lot of miners who had their own ideas on stripping and moving overburden, and of course, when you're bucking that situation, you almost have to back out. So I did. I backed out of Alaska entirely and stayed out of Alaska with it until just recently, because it was very difficult to convince other people that the idea was still basically sound and could be used if they would just give it a chance. And it will be someday a part of Alaska's history, I'm sure. But we have done a lot of work in developing it for uses which, at the time we started permafrost removal in Alaska, we had no idea that it would ever go any further than that. That was basically the idea originally. But as an example, I've got about $85,000 in it. If anybody's interested in figures, that's about what I've got in it in actual cash. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, I'd like to hear some more questions. I haven't run out of questions. Jim?
How does vegetation and garden? How did you come up with fresh stuff when you lived over there?
Well, everybody raised a garden, and we still do today. My wife is a good gardener, and we have lettuce and not tomatoes now, but radishes, and everybody was interested in raising a garden. And as far as our family was concerned, it was a very necessary part of cutting our living costs down to where we could get along. So we had a garden that was about 300 by 300, and we shoveled it over every spring, and my mother with us kids did the gardening and the farming, so to speak. And then later on we shipped in some goats, and we had goat's milk there for many years also. And farming was a very necessary part of living in flat and getting by with fish and reindeer meat, which we always got there when they would bring the herds in and slaughter them just a short distance from flat. And we lived on reindeer meat for many, many years, because beef was just simply too high. And there were many ways of putting up meat. My mother was very good at salting whitefish and salmon. And of course, in the summertime, I fished and sold grayling for $1 a pound there for many years. And all those things were part of the way of cutting cost. In fact, if you didn't do it, I don't know how we would have survived. It would have been impossible. And that's why today I think a lot more home-type farming could be done to cut costs down if people want to do, but that requires shoveling and picking weeds and watering and fighting mosquitoes and doing a lot of things. And people today don't like to do that when you have Safeway right around the corner.
Where did they bring the reindeer herds from?
The reindeer herds came from Holy Cross and the Lohman people, you know, Ralph Lohman and Al Lohman from
yeah,
Nome.
The
they were the backbone, you might say, to the reindeer herd. But there was a fellow by the name of Frank Fox who used to come in every year there. And another thing they did for meat also in the summer months, Wechter Brothers used to bring the beef down the Iditarod River, or down the Yukon River to Ruby, and they actually walked the beef cattle across country from Ruby to Long Creek to Foreman over to Takotna and Ophir, and then they'd slaughter them along the way. And today, when you fly over it, you couldn't believe that such a thing ever took place, but it did. And it probably wasn't very profitable. At least somebody tried to do it. But preparing food that you could get off of the country there, like ptarmigans in the wintertime. My dad used to prospect and take his shotgun out, and he had a party that always had the big baskets on both sides, and he'd come home just loaded with ptarmigan. Well, they've disappeared to a great extent, but at one time there was literally millions of them in our area. And I don't know what is. They're coming back, but they're coming back very slowly. So living off of the land was a very important part of your livelihood. You just learned to live that way, and that was it. And we enjoyed it. And today down there, to a great extent, that whenever the moose season comes along in the fall, we'll get a moose in the community. Everybody will have moose. And of course, well, there's some wonderful gardens in our area. Today, you can see a real wonderful garden there at Flat, at our camp, and over on Prince Creek and Willow Creek. So,
John, did you ever have a rabbit problem?
Yes, we did. We had rabbits. There were years gone by there when the rabbits were so thick that you could, well, you could shoot 1,000 of them with a shotgun a day if you wanted to. And, of course, rabbits and rice, rizzet, as they call it in our language, it was one of the very delicious foods that were on the table a great deal when rabbits were in prime. But then, of course, the rabbits became extinct, and they're coming back now, but they're still very slow. There's very few rabbits in the area. Yeah, very few.
Ducks and geese?
Yes, oh, we have a lot of ducks and geese there now, and they're all around us. In fact, my children feed them, and we have a park all of our own right alongside the camp. And we have nobody shooting them in the area. And that is the wonderful thing about it. There's nobody there now that's shooting them in the spring of the year, especially like they used to do. They used to shoot them in the spring. And of course, in the fall, there's a few of them around there that are shot. But we haven't taken too much time to do much hunting there as far as we're concerned now, feeding a camp and running a crew. And my crew is mostly native help, so they pretty much like the beef if they can get it. So you have to stick to beef. And they live on moose all winter and rabbits and ptarmigan.
What is the history of fur-bearing animals in that area?
Well, probably Flat actually has been a very poor part of Alaska, the area of Otter and Flat, for trapping. And like in the Ruby District, we have a lot of marten, we've had very few. So actually we've had a lot of fox there and a lot of wolf in recent years. But all during the early days there, I think probably there were some beaver, and there always was a lot of beaver on Otter Creek, but beaver and otter. But there never was, as far as I can remember, anybody in the area that ever killed a fat hog trapping. They always went out 40 or 50 miles from there, over on the Kuskokwim, or down the Iditarod, or up the Anoka, or away from there. But the area itself was very poor. And it never did have too many fur-bearing animals.
We never found any lode mining in that country.
No, there's a considerable lode in the area, which I'm looking at now, the Golden Horn Mine, which I hope to do some work on this summer, but in silver and lead and zinc and some free gold. But again, we have a placer deposit there that seemed to have taken first place, and the lode is something that's never been too extensive there, as far as we know anyway. But I think someday we'll be developing that area a lot bigger scale than we are right now. However, we have no roads in there, which makes it real bad. And our transportation now is all air because the river boats have all stopped, so we fly everything in. And due to the fact that you have these high costs, you have a real problem of developing. So we hope to get that road in from the Kuskokwim there someday, 35 miles from Prince Creek to Georgetown. And if we can get that road in, of course, we will have access to the Kuskokwim River, where we can haul our freight in from, and haul our oil in, and haul our wood in, and get lumber and things like that, which now is a major problem. And until such time that we open up transportation, we're almost stymied as far as doing anything more in developing the area, because the cost of development gets up so high.
That road is just about a must.
It is. It is one of the musts. And, of course, one of the things that we're all hopeful might happen is that the present road program that they have, which is the Federal Highways Act, will detour some of that money into pioneer access roads, and then we can build a road which will be passable for us, not necessarily a four-lane highway that's paved. And once, of course, we get a pioneer access road in, then we can get by during the winter months and the fall and do what we have to do on that road. But the way the state is building roads today, why, it'll be many, many years before we ever get a road of that distance in there if it has to go in the present engineering program they have.
John, are there any other minerals mineable in the area to your knowledge?
Yes, there is. There's coal, and I would say the coal could be investigated, and there's a lot of antimony. They have a terrific deposit there of antimony, and I think someday we'll have that deposit investigated, probably. Yeah, there is.
Well, do you think with the coal, there must be would be a chance royal, too?
There could be. However, the geologists say the formation is doesn't lend itself to that, but they have coal there, and they mine some coal there, about 3 miles from flat there, that they used in the blacksmith forges and
cool.
Burned it. Yes, it is. So I think that someday it'll be investigated, because we need it so badly for heat. We have no more wood left in the area. What's left there is new growth, or, you know, it's from what fires have left. So we have to have something to take the place of oil if we're going to take and expand in the area. I said pioneer access roads. When I said, I mean roads that are passable by truck with limited capacity, so to speak, a 6x6, say, that can haul 5 ton. And it doesn't have to be a four-lane. It can be wide enough to carry a tractor or a truck. And then, of course, it doesn't have to have gravel. It can be stripped on the high ridges, and even if you have to stay off of it during the rainy season, why stay off of it? But it would be a road, particularly in the wintertime, that would be passable after freeze-up. And then we would arrange to have our supplies hauled by a truck and tanker, you see, our oil. But we have to fly all our oil now in bulk. Well, there isn't enough volume there anymore, and the water being as it is at times, you take a great deal of risk to get up there with a load of freight, and you might sit there all summer waiting for the water to come up.
Very small stream.
It's a very small river, that's right, and they used to lighter up the river there. They had 7 boats there. They'd start out with a big one, and then they'd lighter to the next one, then the next one, and then they'd finally come up the flat with a mail. That's about what they'd end up with. So that becomes very...
What navigation companies were in there?
Well, there was Day Navigation Company, who was Harry Donnelly and Glenn Day, and then there was Ira Woods of Holy Cross. He was operating in there. And then, of course, in the early days, there was a Wallace Langley operation there. And, by the way, Mr. Wallace, who was a son of the Wallace that had the boats, who became General Sales Manager of General Motors, and retired, came into Flat a year ago and spent a couple of nights with me at Flat to see the place that he was on a boat there when he was about 14 or 15 years old. And he left there, and everybody told him he was making a mistake, and no, he couldn't see any future in gold. So he left, but he came back again. Yeah. But there were many others there. There's many boats there, relics of old boats there, Harry, that tell the story of Iditarod.
Would it be possible to get some of these things out? Is it a matter of money? How much would it cost to move some of these relics?
Well, like this tractor, it wouldn't cost. I'm sure Art Peterson will bring it up if we can get it on a Go Devil and load it on the barge. I don't think that he would charge us anything to bring it back, as he's coming back empty anyway. And some of the other things, the machine that I told you in our house down there, which I'll have to move out because the house is getting old, we could get that up here without any cost ourselves, but we'd have to have a place for it. That's the first thing you've got to have is these things would be easy to get up here because I'm sure everybody would do as I do. They would love to get into the spirit of getting it up here because there's airplanes coming back or some means coming back all the time. Be glad to do it. But you can't dump it off out here and not take care of it. And that's the thing I would hesitate doing. I plan to send the machine up. Jim here asked me about it last year, and I plan to send it up this summer with Bobby Shulton in the boxcar. He will do it for us very gladly. And then I have a man here that's my chief engineer, Arnold Kobler, and in a short period of time, we can make, this summer we'll make some parts that we need for it. We can get it in operation in a very short period of time. And so there are other things that could be gotten. And I think if you appointed individuals in these areas and made a good effort with a lot of propaganda, which you have to have, I think you could get people to cooperate in those areas. And if nothing else, get a lot of pictures for you of these things that you don't have pictures of now. I think that would be very helpful. And then I think probably if you had somebody that could take an airplane and take a trip down in those areas, all it would cost would be the transportation, because once you get there, we are glad to take care of anybody, and they can spend a couple of days or a week and look around and evaluate what there is. I operate the dredge, so I don't have as much time as I would like to do these things, but if somebody else could, Harry here, he doesn't do anything but just take pictures. And
what airplanes fly into there?
Northern
now?
Consolidated or Alaska Airlines out of Anchorage, but Northern Consolidated goes down every week, and you can go to McGrath and then take a trip over to Tocotna and Ophir, and then over to Aniak, and then over to Flat, and then hit on over to Ruby by Galena, and then drive out to Long Creek, and you can make quite a route out of it, to look the thing over, see? And I think you'd find a lot of things of real interest.
Is the road open now to Flat from Ruby?
No, there's a to Pullman. It's not open all the way. It's about 9 miles from Pullman. There's a field at Pullman, and you can land there with a small aircraft. But there are a number of things that I think would be of extreme interest.
Well, I have a lot of things, and I don't know what to do with them. And I think we'll just have to more or less wait till this Alaska 67 gets cleared out.
Yes, well, I think the Alaska 67 is making a real mistake in not providing some temporary shelter now for these things, which you have to get in here, because you can't wait till June of 1967 to get this thing already. These are things that are going to require all winter to do, and you could use like a machinist and a couple of mechanics and so on. All this stuff has to have some plastic surgery, so to speak.
What do you think it would cost to rehabilitate the steam tractor?
Well, I haven't looked at it too closely from that standpoint, but I would say that you'd probably just have to go through the boiler and make sure that it would stand the steam pressure, and that's all you'd have to do to it. So I would say probably $500 would be ample to do that. You'd have to go through you wouldn't have to run the tractor at the pressures they ran it. You just have to raise enough steam so that it would run. So you'd have to go through the pistons and the few little bearings that it has and so on. It isn't too big a job, and it's not too big a machine.
Who is the manufacturer?
No, it's a dreamer. I mean, it was an individual. Yes, I don't think it was any. It's not any forerunner of Caterpillar or Alice Chalmers or International or anybody like that, or Fordson or anyone else.
When was it made?
It was made. I can't recall that. It was shipped in there by boat. It was made in the States, as I recall.
With the history.
Yes, there's still people living that can tell you, and I'm sure there's some pictures available of those days when they were hauling the wood with the tractor. I'm sure that there is a man at Flat that's still living, and his name is Joel Orangi, and he's 88 years old, and I'm sure he has a wonderful memory I'm sure he could tell you the very exact details of this particular era that this tractor operated in. Yeah.
Well, it sometimes seems as if, rather than getting things done under the ball and train method, the free and try system is more workable. In other words, if you retain ownership of the tractor, it seems to be a more profitable situation, and it also seems to be more practical in getting it so that people can use it and see it and appreciate these things. Do you not?
Well, I can agree with you there.
We have so many problems locally of volunteer effort, especially where it involves money, that I'm not so sure but what the latter idea might have more merit in this case, whereas if you or some other individual retain title to it and then working from there.
On the tractor, as an example, it's down there, and it's just a matter of, as far as title is concerned, it belongs to whoever would take the responsibility of getting it out of there and getting it up here and donating it, so to speak. But I think it would have to be within the Centennial Organization and the Historical Society to get the mechanics going, so to speak, to repair and put into shape and a place for this, you see. Those are the things that we in our area down there aren't able to do much about, because we're not close enough with your local conditions and your local program, so to speak. I have yet to see the grounds, or even plan view of what we're talking about out at the Centennial in regards to what room we might have for such a display. And I have asked in the past, even at the Pioneers last fall before I went to the States, that in monuments, so to speak, and other things, I think if we're going to prepare these things for this 67, you can't wait until 67 to do these things. You have to do them in advance of that a considerable distance. So that's why I would like to see if they're going to, and if they do want these things up here, I mean, if we want to get them up here, we have to prepare space for them in a location. They have to have a home.
Yeah, you bet.
See, otherwise they'll go to Disneyland, or they're going to go to the Smithsonian Institute. They're going to go places, I can assure you. I know that for a fact. But I don't like to have them go there, because they should stay up here.
That's part of our history.
Yeah, that is right. And I don't think that we should ever plan to take out these things that we've got here, which are so valuable to Alaska, from a tourist attraction, as an example, and, well, people that are just interested in all this history that took place.
How long will you be here in town, John?
Well, I'll be here till Thursday. I'm leaving Wednesday, actually.
Well, any time before you leave, if you'd like to spend the day or part of the day out looking the project over, I'm glad to take it.
Well, I was just going to ask you, I'm glad you brought that up, because I plan a monument on Discovery there. You probably saw the picture last year in the paper, which I spent a lot of time in designing, I would say. And I want to find out more about the appropriations that have been announced in the paper and so on for other areas, and if they're going to have some money available for these areas, and if Flat or Ophir or any of those places, such as I mentioned, would be able to get any assistance in getting their monuments erected, like flying in concrete and things like that. If there is money available, why, I think it should be advertised, and then people will get to work on it. Now,
as I understood, it's going to be divided up among the different towns in Alaska.
It is.
That's where I'm... Didn't you understand?
Yes, it's going to be rationed out on a certain per capita demand or...
Yes, well...
demand basis.
Yes, and certainly an area like Otter Creek, as an example, is certainly a prime target for a little assistance there. Not that we need a whole lot, but I think we should get some. And I think that the program will move right along if we start. I mean, regardless of your historical society, we all start thinking as pioneers in terms of what I've just suggested here. Basically, that's what it amounts to. And I think if you can get more people to appreciate the facts that I've told you here tonight, I think it would help a great deal. Now, how we're going to do that, I don't know, but I mean, it's a must. And because it really is to me a very interesting subject. I've been through the Smithsonian Institute on 3 different occasions, and I visited many museums, and I've been all over the country in all parts of the United States, and I've taken a great deal of interest in all their historical background. And I'll tell you one thing, Alaska's got more to offer than any of them as far as I'm concerned.
Because, I think so too.
Because I really do. But it can all be buried in alders and grass, in moss, if we don't watch out. Another 10 years and these things will be so far gone that there'll be an impossibility, actually, you see. You wouldn't be able to find them.
The people that have come in here lately really don't realize what we've got here, and they haven't taken hold like they should, and we need them because we're getting
old. Definitely. Well, another thing that you got to be careful of, and this happened to Flat here about 3 years ago, we had a terrible forest fire there, and they hauled in 120 men overnight. And these 120 men, of course, were everything that they picked up in Anchorage and Fairbanks and some of the states. And you know, they went through our buildings there, and I had an awful time. They just pilfered that place something terrifically. And those are the things that we sure hate to see. We caught a lot of them there at the field, but I mean, there was the cash registers, and there was spittoons, and there was many other things that...
those old spittoons, you know, you can't get them anymore.
Those are the things there. They're going to gradually get out if we don't do something about getting a hold of them.
Well, now, to return to Flat, can you give us the name of the roadhouses and things there, and give us a picture of kind of the town as it was?
Well, yes, at Flat, let's go back to Iditarod. We had, of course, one of the big dance halls there was the A.B. Hall, and then we had, before you got to Iditarod, Schirmeyer's Roadhouse, and Tootsie's Place, which was existing there in Iditarod for pretty near 40 years. And then there was a fellow named Bill Crum ran a roadhouse there for many years. And then in Flat, of course, there was a fellow named Paul Azonian who had a roadhouse for many years. And Henry Durant had a roadhouse there for many, many years in the early days. And a fellow by the name of George Adams who ran the roadhouse. And I might add, all these roadhouses also, of course, could deliver you a bottle of White Mule anytime you needed it. But at Discovery, there was my Uncle John Begoy, who was my mother's brother, who was up there for many years, who ran the roadhouse. And, of course, it would take me a little time to think back. I could name many, many more that were in there. And I was just trying to think of some of the other famous ones. There was a lot of famous names in those days down there, too. You know, as I told you, we had... Three Step Louie and Snowshoe Kid and the Hootenanny Kid and
the Goin' Kid
and the Goin' Kid, and they had all these names for these fellows who, in their own way, did something remarkable. And I can't right offhand think of all the rest of them that I used to know, but I have a fella in Flat that could give me a list that would be really interesting to go through, see, because each one of those names relates to a certain part or a certain thing that happened in the area of Otter and Discovery and Iditarod. And
who was the discoverer of the Iditarod now?
Well, there was a fellow by the name of John Beaton and Frank Dykeman, and they came up there in the fall of 1908, as I remember it, and discovered the first trace of gold there. And then they came back in 1909 and did their staking, and the stampede, of course, started in 1909, the latter part of 1909 and 1910, as I recall. But John Beaton actually is considered the discoverer of gold on Otter Creek, and he died. His family, his first wife, and his two children went down on the Sophia when the Sophia sunk in 1918. I believe it was, wasn't it? Yes.
Yes.
They were on that boat, and they were drowned. So John Beaton also, this is rather coincidental, but he was riding with Schonbeck on a trip from Ophir to Cotton, I believe, somewhere in that area, and he also drowned in a pickup. And that was rather a sad thing. But, yeah.
He ran off the road over by Ophir.
Yes, before they got to a bridge or something. Yes, that was a funny thing. But, and then Frank Dyckman, of course, Dyckman's Roadhouse, Dyckman's Landing on the Iditarod was one of the stops there for many, many years, and it's on the maps today. And he retired in Alaska and made his fortune and left. He retired to somewhere over in eastern Washington, I heard. Well, then we had many famous names down there. Tom Aiken also was one of the big miners of that early era. And then there was Frank Dawson, who also...
He was on Kennel Creek later.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And then Sam Applebaum came in there and drove the NC Company out of Iditarod. The NC Company had one of the biggest stores, and their building still stands there. Had one of the largest merchandise stores and everything else in Alaska, I think. And Sam came in there, and they had a boat that froze in on the Iditarod River in the fall, and of course they couldn't do anything with the supplies, and he got a couple of horses together, and there was frozen eggs and rotten hams and bacon and whatnot. And anyway, he started a store, and that's what drove the NC Company out from that. He built up a small empire there, and he made his first million there and went out in the early 20s and played the stock market, went broke, and then he come back and after the war, or before the war actually, and made his second million. And went outside,
trader?
Huh?
Just as a trader?
As a trader and a storekeeper, and I'll tell you, it's a history which...
He used to be a fur buyer,
a fur buyer, and, well, by the very Sam Applebaum, you can tell that he knew how to make money, and he sure made it. Yes, sir, but he used to operate the store, and I did a rod there, which, as I said, started from these just salvage supplies, and then gradually he built up into a very large enterprise there at Iditarod and Flat. And what he used to do was pack clothing and gloves and socks and everything to the men right out on the creeks and sell it to them, which they appreciated, in other words. Then there was Dave Strandberg and his family, who were on Flat Creek, and Charlie Strandberg, who was also up here in later years. They were also there. Oh, there's many
Rivers.
And the Rivers family. In fact, Ralph Rivers studied law on the bank of the Otter Creek, up on what they call Malamute Pup.
Well, didn't his father, a guy, study law there too?
Yes,
he told me he was a dredge master, and he
studied law. he was a timekeeper for the Googs there. The Guggenheim timekeeper. Yeah, for the Guggenheims, they call them the Googs. Yes, and the Guggenheims were in there with a very large dredge, a big 6-cubic-foot dredge, and operated there for many years. And they shut down in 1917 or somewhere in that area. And it's a rather surprising thing that my father also had a lease on all their holdings there after they quit, and we mined on their property for a couple of years, and then when the disposal of the whole dredge and all their claims came into being done, why, there was a fellow up here by the name of Albright and Taylor, who were in the law business for many years. They were the attorneys down there, and Dave Brown, and through the finagling that went on, we lost the property, and Dave Brown got it now, and of course we still kind of have a bad taste in our mouth over the transactions that took place. But in those early days, there was a lot of things going on, and whoever got there first usually made the most of it. We had a very famous trial up here under Harry Donnelly and the Riley Investment Company too, which was very, it went on up here for 3 cases, I believe, and out in the States for 2, and with Walter Sackow. And it was a very, very important part of the history of Flat. In fact, it sort of changed the history, but as trials go in Fairbanks out of Flat, we never were successful in Fairbanks. And Harry Donnelly lost the case. However, his case, Mr. Reed being a surveyor here, was based upon 2 surveys, one by a man who had died who made the original survey, which was the government survey, and Sam Cotton, who made the survey for Walter Sackhoff and Judge Clegg. And they accepted the new map up here, which none of us go by in Flat to this day, but nevertheless that won the case. And it was quite interesting. Hmm. Yeah.
Sam Cotton.
Yes, yeah, Sam did the surveying.
He used to work for me.
Is that right?